Today we welcome Deputy Chief Chris Stewart to the podcast. He's a 27-year veteran of the Phoenix Fire Department and has served in many sections across the organization. Regardless of his position or function, however, he claims lifelong, unadulterated B-shifter affiliation. Today he's going to share with us some of his thoughts on growing up in the PFD, command training, and some thoughts on operating effectively with PD partners in violent incidents. Let's get down to it. Welcome to the Fireground Fitness Podcast. I'm your host, Rain Gray. Here, we're going to talk about all things pertaining to life on and off the fireground. The opinions expressed are mine and those of the guest. So, let's get started. Chris, welcome to the Fireground Fitness Podcast. And I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to sit down and talk shop with me and to talk firemanship. And but before we dig in to the super fun stuff, give me a little background on who you are, where you grew up, what are some of your influences?
So I'm actually from the city of Phoenix. I'm one of the few, well, it's not few now, but growing up, I was one of the few Phoenix natives. I'm proud to say that I'm probably one of the only people in the Phoenix Fire Department who was born at Phoenix Baptist Hospital. I don't know if that's something to be proud of today, but it's a fact. I grew up here. I went to high school, Shadow Mountain High School. Went to grade school at Madison Number One. In all honesty, I think the Phoenix Fire Department raised me because I remember high school, and then I remember wanting this small period of time of wanting to become a firefighter, a 2 or 3 year period. And then I remember being a firefighter, and I can see now there's important things that my parents taught me. Don't get me wrong at all, but the person I am today is 100% attributed to the people in the organization of the Phoenix Fire Department. There's zero doubt in my mind about that.
Cool. Well, that's going to make this a really interesting interview, because I think that one of the big questions that comes to my mind when we talk about the path that we end up on, but it's, what are some of the things that have influenced who you've become, right? Mm-hmm. And part of this job leaves its mark on us indelibly, no matter what we do. So you can't escape it. So all you can do is hope to get something good from it, right? Let it shape who you are. But there's a few, besides the fire department, and we're going to go down the fire department path, but there's a few things that that I know that you're involved with that are really, really cool and that I want you to talk to. So when I first met you was mountain biking. And you big smile on your face. It's one of our big loves that we share. Mm-hmm. When did you start riding?
I started riding in 1988. My first bike was a Diamondback Ascent EX because the gentleman that I was working with, who was a fitness guy, who was a friend of my dad's, he was a power lifter, weightlifter guy forever. He was actually helping me get ready to get on the job, go through the physical agility test before the CPAT was around, and he was also into cycling, and which is kind of an odd, those two things don't really run in parallel very often.
Yeah.
He got me into mountain biking, so I was riding with a bunch of 50-year-old dudes in the Phoenix Mountain Preserve, and we would go 3 or 4 miles in the beginning and think, wow, man, we went a long way today. And then obviously knowing now what we know, it really isn't that long, but it was a cool accomplishment. And so I've been riding since then, and had a really good time of being able to go places and ride, and then being able to do some cool events with some fun people, and some of my most memorable ones are teams that you and I raced on together, especially down at the 24 Hours in the Old Pueblo. Yeah. And some epic stories to these days.
I would say some of the most memorable components of that are the least fun.
Yeah, exactly. But do we laugh about them and smile about them?
Yeah, we're not suffering.
Right.
We lived.
Racing 24 hours were basically probably 18 to 20 of that, 18 or 20 of those hours where it was raining really hard.
Freezing.
In the middle of the desert.
Muddy and slipping chains. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was freaking miserable.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was good stuff. Good stuff. It builds character.
Right.
And here we are, better men because of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, without a doubt. At least we have stories.
Right, exactly. So you started, well, I love that mountain biking is part of your training to get on this job. I love that. Back when it had, I mean, that's got zero relevance to the physical agility.
very true. I think it just made me a little bit tougher. I'll take that.
Right, there you go. Take what you can from it. So here's my question. How old were you when you got on the job?
I was 20 years old when I got hired by the fire department, and I was 22 when I got hired to be a firefighter. So basically,
because of the red shirt period.
Yep. So I spent time as the radio runner for a little over a year prior to. So I was a civilian employee of the fire department, working they called it CAD at the time, that section of the fire department. And basically, I took care of the portable radios for the fire department. So I was 20 years old when I got hired.
Right. Do you think that the organization might have done that to you on purpose as an opportunity to grow up a little bit, or what do you think?
I don't know. I think that the opportunity was there because the very first radio runner got hired to go into the academy, and I was just one of a few people that applied for that opening when it happened. And if that is the case, I'm really glad it happened. I guess I've never thought about it, whether it was truly purposeful. If it was, thank you. And if it wasn't, then I was able to at least get out of it what I need to.
Well, at the very least, as competitive as it is to get on the job, it gave you an opportunity to be in proximity to the job and learn a lot. And I can see some value in that. I think about that when young folks are approaching the fire service. You know, they want to get right in and be a firefighter, but it's competitive. So how do you increase your competitive edge? Well, take a job with the city and, you know, go and meet people and network and learn and grow, and applies at all levels in the organization. But when you're 20, sometimes you don't have that perspective.
True. And I wish I could say it was purposeful. It wasn't. It was just, it seemed like a cool job at the time.
Yeah.
And it was a cool job. But yeah. I will say this, doing that for a year and then being a red shirt for roughly a year and a half, there really wasn't anything or any part of the fire department I hadn't had exposure to. And if something needed to be done in my role as a red shirt, I knew exactly who to call or where to go and how to get it done. And that was a really cool thing that I still use that information today.
That's interesting. So I think about being a glorified gopher for the city and running errands all around the city. You definitely are meeting people and getting connected to people. When, you know, I came on the job and I was not a red shirt and went straight into the academy, and the cats who had already been serving as a red shirt, they just knew stuff. They had information. I'm like, what? How do they know that? I had no idea. I was completely naive when it came to that. And I'm like, man, these guys have all these connections and all these resources available to them. I had no idea.
Well, the individuals involved typically don't look at being a redshirt as that great of a thing. I mean, they're appreciative for the job, but they want to go to the academy. That's the whole goal. They're here. But I don't think there's one single one of us that have been redshirts that actually regret it in the end.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely. I think when you look back, once you have the blue shirt on and you're settled into your career, you're like, okay, all's well. I'm here now. I've landed. It's good. Well, that's a great perspective for anybody who is on their way in. You know, it's a great opportunity to not snub their nose at it.
Without a doubt.
So tell me a little bit about the progression of your career. So you came on the job when we were kind of in a tough time organizationally. And how did that affect you as a new firefighter? Your thoughts on the job?
Well, you're young and you're pretty naive, or at least I was. And I think I understood what was going on, but you really don't understand until you become a real adult, you know, in the real world, and to really understand the value of what was actually happening.
Right.
It didn't feel like the fire department was in a bad place. I think at the highest levels of the organization, they knew and understand what the problem was. And it was a huge, huge deal to have the membership come up substantially as they did to say, no, we're willing to take a day off without pay.
Right.
But that was not unanimous, by the way. There were I believe it was actually 9 people that voted against that. So funny, the things you remember. But and I don't know who they are. Doesn't necessarily even matter at that right. at this time. But
well, I'm just realizing that we had this conversation before I hit record. So let me give a little bit of background. So what happened was a bit of a financial crisis, and so the union and labor voted to do furloughs in order to keep how many members? How many academy?
There were 6 of us that were red shirts, and then there were only 11 people hired in my class total. 6 of us became red shirts, 5 of us went into the academy with the previous red shirts.
So the objective of the furloughs was to save those new positions and to, you know, continue to help the fire department move forward.
Yeah, they were saving the 11 positions there plus a number of positions that could have potentially been laid off.
Okay. So to back to what you were saying. So did you really feel like you had a perspective of that?
But I didn't appreciate it for really what it was. I was happy to have a job. I loved what I was doing. Every day was cool. And you know, just going to work, whether it was being a red shirt or you know, at the academy or on probation, everything was new and everything was cool. So yeah. You know, I just absolutely did not have a global perspective of truly what's going on, and definitely didn't have the appreciation that I think I have now for what the membership truly did at that time.
Yeah, I think it is interesting how I remember being young on the job and or young in life, and people like, well, you know, one day you'll understand. And I find myself saying that to people now, and I'm like, oh, I guess I've gotten a little old.
Yeah,
now I'm starting to say these things to these young cats, like someday you'll get it. When you have kids, you'll understand. When you have so many years on the job, you'll understand, or what have you.
And it is one of those things where all of a sudden, it's not as if it is kind of like the light switch coming on. You're like, oh, I actually now am in the position where, I do actually get it now.
I almost feel like it's like a dimmer switch, or like the sunrise, like it slowly creeps in, and all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah,
I suddenly understand why this is important, or why XYZ is important. So let me ask you this: early in your career, what's one of the hallmark or one of the events that maybe you feel has shaped who you are today as a young firefighter? One of the things that took place when you were young on the job.
I'm not 100% sure if it's like singular events, but I think it's kind of a process of the indoctrination to what the Phoenix Fire Department was and is to a certain extent now. I was working in a place where, I do have an example. So I was fortunate enough, when you're a young firefighter on the Phoenix Fire Department, in the heyday of the Phoenix Fire Department doing symposiums and doing a lot of engagement with the National Fire Service because of the fire chief. And we had multiple symposiums, the health and fitness seminar, we had the hazard zone seminar. We had there was even another labor management one that we did for a couple years, and I can't remember exactly the name. But when you're new on the job and you're the least paid firefighter on the job, you luck into details, you know, overtime details, where you get to go pick people up at the airport and take them to their hotel and things
right.
like that. And so you'll pick, you know, I vividly remember picking up the fire chief from Pasadena, California. I picked up the fire chief from a small department in Minnesota, Joel Hewitt, really, really good guy, still around today. And I remember getting quizzed in the vans every single time I'd pick them up. And some of the guys I would actually start to recognize because I got them more than 1 year more than one symposium. And you would get quizzed about what it is to really work in the Phoenix Fire Department. You know, and I'm fat, dumb, and happy. I'll tell you. And the common question was, is it really that good? And it was really easy to say, no, yeah, it really is that good. I don't have really anything to compare to.
Of reference.
But all this stuff that you're saying or you're asking me or I can tell you about the Phoenix Fire Department is 100% true and 100% real. And yes, it is that good here. And so that was, I guess, my earliest frame of reference of what it meant to work for the Phoenix Fire Department and how truly progressive and or, you know, good at our jobs. I think, at least in my mind, we were and are.
What are, from your early days, what are one of the core philosophies or core ideas that you felt were being heralded by folks? Like, what are some of the things that people were recognizing Phoenix for back in those days?
First and foremost, it was customer service. You know, the boss started talking to the organization about customer service, and that was really, really unique because they were either patients or victims or, you know, any other name that you can think of that we use regularly in our line of work. And and his true recognition of, no, they're actually customers. Yeah. And you're here to do it. We're in a customer service job. And now this customer service job has some really unique demands and really unique parts of the work. But it actually really is, when you boil it down, it is customer service. And that recognition of what customer service is, and it didn't mean we were any less effective on the fire ground. It didn't mean we were any less effective in any of the other specific skills that we have to do. But it was this overall mindset of, no, we're going to do what's right for the community. We're going to do what's right for the customer. And shoot, there were journal articles, you know, fire service journal articles arguing against that fact. You know, while we were trying to say, no, this is customer service.
Just change the way you look at it.
Yeah, and so there were people who were attacking the Phoenix Fire Department and attacking Bruno for those things. And that is a big, big deal in my head. And then actually being safe and smart at what we do. So interestingly enough, Brett Tarver getting killed in 2001 at the Southwest Supermarket fire. I had been a captain for 9 months maybe when that happened. And so that became him dying, that incident, and then the whole recovery process. That's like was my most formative years as a company officer.
Yeah.
So I got to essentially grow up as a company officer, living through this set of experiences that we went through in the recovery, and so that has framed me, or framed my thought process as a company officer, and then as a chief officer. So I got to say that was a pretty, well, it's an important event for many, many different things, and a sad event for many reasons. But that actually has driven my thought process and what I hold valuable and important, and my organizational values, my operational values for the fire service, or for the Phoenix Fire Department specifically, has really come from that incident. And then the people who were a part of that process.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I was at a couple 3 years on the job when Brett died, and it rattled me in a way, because here I am at the front end of my career, and I full of bravado, full of spit and vinegar, and I'm like, oh, we talk about line of duty death, and here's one right in my own backyard. Here's one happening right now in front of my face. And then I had the opportunity to participate in a lot of the recovery drills, watching the crews come in and say, well, we can do a rescue. And then recognizing that, no, a couple of folks, you can't just throw a guy over your shoulder. And this isn't about disparaging people's capacity, their individual work capacity, but recognizing that the nature of the work is different than we realized. You know, I had that idea, run in there, get them, and out you go. But the operational context inside of a burned out structure or a fire, that a building that's under duress at a time, is way different. And then the stress that's on you, not to mention the physical location of the firefighter. And Brett was a big man. There's that as well. You're not just going to throw a 300-pound load over their shoulder and walk out. So we have to be smarter. And I think that for me, recognizing that, we sat down and looked at that process, and we stepped back from it, and we looked at the whole process of rescuing one of our own, and realized that it's way more difficult. We had the humility to realize it's way more difficult than we first thought. And I think that was a real, for me personally, that was a massive takeaway from that period of my career. And yeah, it changed me a lot as well.
Yeah, I think that things that I look back on, so I'm fortunate. So some of my friends and the places I was working, I was directly, I had a front row seat. I wasn't participating, but I was watching the thought process of some of the command officers who were going through this iteration of, all right, how do we do this better? And they came up with some ideas that ultimately did not turn out to be worthy ideas, or they didn't pass muster when we actually put them into play. And so what I will say, that one thing that impressed me the most organizationally was the level of humility that we had from the top to the bottom in figuring this stuff out. Because those command officers very easily could have doubled down on bad ideas. Because they are the command officers, and they are in charge, and they are, no, we have the experience. Well, we're going to, no, this, you have to make this work. Well, they listened, and they said, because it was the membership that came up with the best ideas, honestly and truly. And they said, no, you're asking us to do this. It ain't working, but this is what we see. And the idea of rescue sector, the idea of all this other stuff, is the membership proved that stuff to be less effective and provided the command officers with really what is our practice today of the Mayday help order and layering of resources and tactical reserves and ultimately on deck and one tactical radio channel and that sector officer managing the Mayday. All that came from because we tried some ideas that didn't work. The membership came up. The people doing the work actually came up with the best ideas. And then the bosses said, right on, that's what we're going to do. And so not many organizations, fire departments, I guess, across the United States can say that they have they are confident enough to have the humility to try stuff. And when it doesn't work, to listen to the people doing the work, to actually make the impact of, no, this is probably what's best. And the cool thing is we did a bunch of exercises or drills then, got a bunch of data, had smart people, Dr. Perry and those folks come in and do the true mashing of the numbers, and we learned stuff. And then now in Don Abbott's Project Mayday, those things are proving to be valid. So actual data that is, 18 years removed, I guess, from the actual incident is now proving what we felt, or we came away saying, this is our best practice. This later data is saying, no, it absolutely is. This is the way Maydays are really playing out. And that's pretty cool. I don't think anybody really we felt like it was righteous and justified as an organization, but now it's being validated. That is really cool.
Yeah, I think sometimes the intuitive ideas that we know work, it's good to have that data to back it up, right? And it's interesting though, so you and I have talked a lot about fire dynamics over the last few years, and there's research that goes back to the 50s that is now, we look at it now and we go, oh yeah. If you shut the door and you stop the air entrainment, it makes the conditions better. If you put water on the fire and take the heat away, the environment gets better, right? So that stuff was stuff that was practiced in those days, and they had a little bit of study on it, and then the science kind of went away. And so it's really cool to me to see that the fire service is embracing data collection, embracing some science, and allowing that evidence to help shape and inform what we do. As long as you couple it with common sense and you couple it with practical application and boots on the ground, that knowledge is really tremendous and can help us move forward into the future in a big way. So, I mean, it's interesting and enlightening that is something that started, was an influence to you back in those days. We started with some data collection, had a little bit, we had members out doing the drills, exercising it, and then saying, is this working or not? And now we have more data that helps reinforce that. It's really smart and I think helpful.
And independent data, right? It wasn't. These aren't the same
right.
people.
It's good
doing
research.
That. Yeah, exactly. It's not. We're not cooking our own numbers.
Right. Exactly. It's not just self-aggrandizing here. It's good reinforcement. So as you promoted up, you went into some really different sections. You worked on busy trucks as a captain, and then you went out into became a chief officer. What are some of the things that changed for you going from a company officer to become a chief officer? Because you start down that path as a company officer where you start your mindset for risk changes, your tolerance for risk changes as a company officer. But how does that change for you as a chief officer?
Primarily, the biggest driver, the biggest influence in that change is you now are more of a spectator than you are a participant in the activity. And I think the farther you get, you step back and physically remove yourself from the true risk and the true risk taking and the action, you obviously get a broader picture of it. Mm-hmm. And it's way more difficult to sit and watch other people take risk than it, from a distance. And actually have a role and responsibility in it and have some ownership in their welfare and than it is to stand up close and be very clear in your head, no, I've got to get this certain set of things done, and I can do it because of experience, and I have a reasonable understanding of what's going on right here, and I'm comfortable doing this, and I'm comfortable doing it with my crew because I know them very well. And you may actually be it helps you because I think you're so close to it that you know exactly when and where your limits are, or when your things are going to happen, your triggers to make some changes or do something different, or to say, where this is a little too dangerous, or this is a little too risky, or we're not being effective here. Let's try this. But I think as you remove yourself, you start watching other people, and I've seen this more than once, and I have two people in mind when I say this, is they were both working as fits with me or went on to be promoted to battalion chiefs. And I vividly recall being with a really good ladder captain who happened to just be driving me for that day, and we pulled up on a three-story office complex, and we had a decent fire up on the third floor, and he is watching his crew on the roof. And this is a legitimate fire. They're legitimately taking some significant risk for real reasons. I totally supported what they had going on. And he looked at me and he said, I don't like this one bit. And I'm like, you just had a very, you don't realize it, maybe, I don't know, but you just became much more enlightened about the work and the job we do. And that distance, this incident went well. They did exactly what they were supposed to. The engine company's on the inside, the ladder company on the roof. Everything turned out just the way it was supposed to. But he was removed from it. He was looking at it, something that he would have zero issue doing with his company right then and there.
Right.
And feel very comfortable and very confident about it, and actually be able to defend it very clearly after the fact. But being removed now, watching it and having a sense of responsibility and really zero power to actually physically save them or change something if they needed to was an eye-opening experience. I've had that multiple times. One of my best friends in the world, once he got promoted to battalion chief, drove over to the old battalion chief that he worked for. He said, I just want to apologize to you right now for everything I did. All the pain and misery that I know that I caused you for the last 10 years. And those type of moments are actually they're pretty cool. They're pretty informative. And if you can take that new perspective that you get as a responding chief officer, as an incident commander, and at the same time somehow stay attached to the work, stay attached to the people that are doing the work, maintain that respect for the work, and how difficult it is and can be, and develop some patience. The first battalion chief I ever worked for as a fit, if I learned nothing from him, was patience. patience and patience for things that are happening in front of you, patience for the people who work in your battalion. And I think about that actually a lot. And so those things, that change in perspective, but staying connected to what it really is. And you now, just because you are the command officer, you're the chief officer of the IC or whatever, you don't know everything. Now you should be experienced. You should be competent. You should have a good understanding. But you're open-minded enough to really pay attention to what's going on. And what we tell firefighters and what we tell captains in these days is it depends. Well, chief officers need to understand that it depends and look at things individually for what is happening, whether it's on the fire ground or all the other things that we deal with.
Yeah. You brought up a good point that the issue about patience is an interesting one, because the pacing of work, when you're in the middle of it and you have a tool in your hand or you have a radio in your hand and you're in the smoke and you're working with your crew and things are happening around you, that pace is very different and the timing of it is very different when you're sitting in the cab of a truck and you're looking up at your guys and looking out or listening to them on the radio or what have you. The expectation for how time moves, the way time moves in the cab of that truck is totally different, and that is a really interesting thing to try and remember. I think getting, you talk about staying connected to the work. So to me, I feel like that's a training issue, right? So how do we get our chief officers to maintain that connection? Because one of the biggest complaints I hear from guys in the field, and on my own truck, et cetera, is, those chiefs don't get it. They're removed. So how do we, and of course, there's varying degrees of that and layers of that, but how do I help my battalion chief stay connected to the work?
So some of that, there's a certain percentage of that that's just an excuse by the membership. They just, they don't get it.
It's reciprocal too.
Oh yeah, completely. And totally.
You don't understand what their expectations are and how they work.
Yeah. Without a doubt, it's a two-way street. As you promote and as you move up in any fire department, any organization, you do get farther away from the task level. 100% valid. If you lose perspective of the fact that, the Phoenix Fire Department exists today to go on calls, to answer 911 calls. Now, we do a lot of medical calls because we're a fire-based EMS system, so that's a dominant percentage of what we do. But we still are going on plenty of fires, and we still are going on plenty of other calls, technical rescue, hazmat, those types of things, violent incidents that put us, they have a legitimate volume of risk and a legitimate volume of danger in them for the community. But that is the reason why the Phoenix Fire Department exists. It's not because of whatever administrative function you're now responsible for within the organization. And something that I carry with me from Terry Garrison regularly is the fact that if you are not running those calls, your job is to support those who are running those calls. Every single position within the organization, that's what the system is built to do. So that perspective, as you promote, you may not be on the front line. You may not be directly involved in that task level, but my job is to support it. So whether for me personally, whether I'm in safety, whether I'm in training, whether I'm at Homeland Defense, is I am supporting Engine 1 talking to Mrs. Smith.
Right. So what I hear you saying is that no matter where you are in the organization, you have to understand the mission and that and what your role is in affecting that mission. I've thought about this over the years, in different places I've been, but for me personally, no matter what I choose to do, it's about Mrs. Smith. And whatever position or function I have in the organization, it's an eye toward how are we providing service delivery? What does that service delivery look like? And are we able to make it better? So, as a firefighter on a fire truck, what can I do today to be the most effective to serve Mrs. Smith? And if I'm the chief of the department, it's an understanding of what has to happen so that trucks can roll and so that Mrs. Smith can get the service delivery that's required. And it's about the end game, and that's a really important thing to keep in mind, I think, at every level. So, for that that understanding of the work that needs to get done. And I think it's about focusing on training and going to training. I don't care where you are in the organization, no matter what you've done, at a certain point, you have to re-engage with the operational level training, right? You've got to be connected to what's taking place. And, we do a great job of providing an opportunity for our chief officers to go to training, even if they're still in an administrative position. I think that's really kind of cool. We have the Command Training Center, and we invite them down there to participate in drills and do tabletops and talk through operational stuff, even if they're managing, resource. They still come down and train, and I think that's a great way to stay connected with the mission. And it's, I just really appreciate that.
Well, if you look at a comparison to business, look at giant businesses, very successful businesses that have lost contact or lost connection with their customer. They have either suffered and withered and died, or they've maybe fortunately made some real adaptive change to become connected once again to their customer. We're no different than that. If we lose that, we'll suffer the same exact fate. It's not as if the Phoenix Fire Department or any town fire department is going to go out of business, so to speak. But you will not be nearly as good or nearly as effective if you're not connected to the customer and the community.
Yeah, you've got to be paying attention to what the need is, right? Because the need can change. It can evolve. Yeah, that can be a whole podcast all on its own, because there's a lot down there. You told me before, and we've talked about this, and I already know this about you, but you've had several different assignments as a, once you were battalion chief, and then once you became a deputy chief. So what are, you worked in EMS, and you worked at Homeland, and see this broad perspective. What does that mission look like to you when we talk about these different elements and how they serve the community? How does Homeland serve the community?
So, yeah, all the positions I've had really, at least in my own mind, have a pretty unique connection to the community or supporting the firefighters. So Homeland, for instance, is our first and foremost job in Homeland Defense is to actually work in a really cooperative, healthy, productive way with our police partners. So we are one of the very few bureaus in any large city across the United States that actually shares office space and shares a mission with our police partners. So our Homeland Defense Bureau is housed in the Phoenix Fire Department, and we have police officers from commander all the way down to officer assigned to that bureau, and they work alongside firefighters of various ranks and other civilian support folks and public health and planning and grant type functions that all are working on this mission of how do we keep the community safer through intelligence, through the simple coordination and communication that we need between fire and law enforcement, and how do we better support the law enforcement side, how do we better support our police officers, and how do we take some of the information and the intelligence that we get from the police side of our business to improve the safety and improve the situational awareness and the operational functionality of our crews out in the field. We're operating in dangerous environments in our city, the evidence shows that firefighters are not getting killed from violence on necessarily clear-cut violent incident type calls. They're getting injured and killed on incidents that start out as a fire call or dispatch as a fire call or start out as an EMS call or dispatch as an EMS call. And we've just recently gone through the process of kind of looking at all that data, and it's a really, really small number. I think it's one, if I recall correctly, that's been killed on an actual violent incident. All the other firefighters that have been killed in the line of duty from violence since 2000.
Let me clarify. When you're saying that, are you talking about kind of the mass shooting type violent incidents?
Yeah, so active shooter situations.
That's the word I was looking for.
Active shooter situations or a complex coordinated terrorism attack, any of that type of stuff. So since 2000, the overwhelming percentage of firefighters have been killed by violence have been on calls that started out as something else, whether it's been purposeful or something that unfolded there. You know, purposeful, I mean, they were called there specifically to be ambushed, or violence broke out on the call just for whatever reason. The Homeland Defense Bureau is then there in place to work with our law enforcement. Is okay. How do we do this better? How do we protect? How do we teach, train, improve the mindset and the size up abilities of our firefighters in environments that it aren't the fire ground, that isn't a hazmat call, that isn't a technical rescue call. It's just now we're assessing people rather than environments. And how do we do that better? We're pretty good at walking in, telling, being able to decide fairly quickly if somebody's sick or not.
Right.
But we don't we haven't always had the ability to walk in and to predict whether somebody has ill intent.
Right. It wasn't our wheelhouse.
Right. Exactly. And that has sat firmly in the police departments, and they've done a fantastic job of helping us improve and putting us in a better situation. We've actually have some really good results and some really good case studies that we can look at internally that help us with that. For instance, the Homeland Defense Bureau, that our job and mission is to help firefighters be safer and to help them do their job better through a very unique set of things of working with law enforcement and using intelligence and our connection through our state counterintelligence system to the Fed counterintelligence the federal intelligence bureaus, I guess would be the right word, to be able to help our firefighters be safer. And then there are times when we provide pretty fantastic information to them that helps them do their job and then ultimately makes the community safer.
Yeah. I feel like that is one of the biggest changes that's happened in my career. Oh, excuse me. I'll have to cut that out.
I leave it in. That's true. That means it truly is firefighters actually talking.
So one of the biggest changes that has impacted my career is this idea. And I remember being told early on, hey, we're the good guys. Everybody loves firefighters and the poor cops. Everyone hates them. And I believe that's true still to a certain degree. However, the operational context that we find ourselves in is evolving. And rapidly evolving, and firefighters are routinely getting drawn in to bad situations by bad guys, and who have ill intent. And so it's good that we're taking steps to kind of look at that and to understand the operation, how better to communicate with PD and mitigate those emergencies more rapidly. So I know that we've done a lot of training on radio communications over the years with our PD partners. And being able to get on PD channels and interface with PD directly and take away the lag time that maybe goes into the cross communication between PD alarm room and fire alarm room. And so that's really helpful for us. So that's I feel like it's a very modern concept. And it's kind of right on time. It's targeted to our mission as it's evolving now and as it's changing. And, it makes me wonder, what's next, right? And how is the operational context for us going to change over the next 10 years? And I don't know. Any insight on that?
Yeah, I wish I...
or you got a crystal ball for that?
Well, I think it's the improvement of that. Mm-hmm. So I'll toot our own horn a little bit. I think we're pretty unique in this. I think we've taken it to a new level in the way that I think the Phoenix Fire Department has done historically. So I fully appreciate that, and I see a lot of things improving for us in that way, and hopefully we can influence others to improve in similar ways. I don't know what it looks like because it is changing. Right now the big conversation is about ballistic protection for firefighters or ballistic protection for EMS folks. I don't know. We have to have a full understanding of what that ballistic protection is for and what it's meant to do, and it's in a different context than law enforcement, or it should be and taken in a different context as law enforcement in my mind. But it's very difficult to have this thought of, okay, if we're getting killed on EMS calls, if we're getting killed on fire calls because we're either getting lured in or bad things end up happening. The fire service has never been one to say, well, no, we don't want, we're going to ignore a certain set of PPE for our members. So how do you integrate ballistic protection into firefighting equipment? That does not connect with me right now, and I don't think there's a reasonable way, and I even think people have done some interesting research on it and maybe even a little bit of legitimate testing on it. And to put firefighters in ballistic protection and then put them in their firefighting equipment makes it very difficult for us to do our job legitimately.
Right.
So how do we attack the problem differently? How do we do that? And I'm not 100% sure what the answer is, but it's going to become an issue for us, or it is an issue. We're just like barely looking at the tip of it right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's hugely important that we take, and I'm going to use an expression that I hear you say all the time, which is take the emotion out of it and step back, detach from the problem a little bit, and look at it from a 360 degree perspective. Right? We've got to, you talked about it being different than the way PD uses it, and I think that's a really important thing to discern is how is it affect us on the fire ground, and can you operate on the fire ground in ballistics, and then you talk about all the different things that these things are designed to protect you against, and is that really the same threat that we are facing? And I don't have the answer to that, but I just think it's important that we step away and instead of making an emotional decision, we have to be rational and thoughtful, and we have to have evidence-based practices and do what's in the best interest of our membership. And a knee-jerk reaction, while it feels good sometimes, doesn't necessarily take us to the next level. It just puts a Band-Aid on something or puts a patch on it. It makes us feel good in the moment, but doesn't always carry through.
Yeah, develops a false sense of security.
Yeah. I think when we talk about one of the things that we're doing that I think is really, really effective is focus on size up and focus on that strategic understanding of what the operation is at any given moment. And so when we start talking about violent incidents and kind of the new operational paradigm, we have to be able to size it up on the front end. That piece is really, really important. And I know that's what are your thoughts on that as far as taking it from the fire ground to the violent incident?
So it's at least in my mind, it's a very similar process. The function and the actual process, I guess, is very similar. But the elements of how we're gaining that information and the methodology in which we're gaining that information is the difference. Because I know law enforcement will tease us, and I'll take it and own it all day long. We're going to stage down the street. We're going to be out of the fray in the very beginning, but I thoroughly agree that that's the best position we should take on most incidents. So if you're staging a block or two away, how do you size up an incident? Because we don't stage a block or two away and then ask the fire ground incident commander to size up the incident, from a couple blocks away. But we're asking company officers and potentially chief officers to do that on violent incidents where they can't see anything. So the only way you can do that is through communication. And for us, the only way we've been able to do it is actually in a legitimate way functioning on the police tactical radio channels. And we for the past couple of years have had the ability to access, and we've had the training and encouragement and worked out a lot of the operational bugs of communicating with the cops and the language barrier a little bit and that type of stuff. And we're in a position now where it's second nature. I say regularly, I think if we tried to take it away from our firefighters now, they would revolt. So now in a real way, as we're responding, we're able to listen to what PD has going on. We're able to, when we arrive and we do stage, we're able to say, hey, look, we're staged in this location. And it has demonstrated a true connection and a true level of some type of unified operation. And we've talked about unified command in a big way, a thousand other ways. But it's always done with incident commanders, it's always done with bosses. But how do you do it in our terminology is in that fast attack for that fast attacking company officer?
Right.
So you have, police officers showing up and starting to engage whatever's happening. And you have firefighters and crews showing up and starting to figure out where and how or if they can truly engage what's going on. And now we have a we have an ability to do it by listening, number one, and then number two, communicating with them on their level, you know, balancing not getting in their way and not you know, we don't want to be asking dumb questions when they're legitimately about to engage the bad guy, so to speak. So we're learning that, and we're getting better at it every day. And that's the tool. That, to me, that's the most powerful size up piece we have. We cannot sit. So on the fire ground, if you lose communication with one of your key tactical positions, what do we do about it? Well, we may change strategies. We may try and fix a problem. There's a litany of things from very minor to very significant on the fire ground.
Right.
When we were going, before we did this, we were going into violent incidents and we weren't going to communicate at all. And we were going to wait and we were going to play that silly game of blinking flashlights at each other from a block away. It made zero sense. And so now, in order to be able to legitimately do that, you have to legitimately be able to size that up. And the other part of it is, and I feel pretty strongly about that, is the fire service, the EMS folks, or the combination of the two, understanding that we are not, this is one of the very few hazard zones in which we work where we are not the hazard mitigators. That is law enforcement's job. And so understanding that is important, and then figuring out, okay, so now how do we fit in? And how do we actually do it effectively?
And how do we support them without becoming part of the problem?
Right, right. And understand truly what they're doing. And we are so fortunate right now in this environment we have with our police department and the people we have from the police chief down to the folks who work at Homeland and in patrol and in their training, that they are they're an enlightened group that is like, yes, we have to do this better. And they have been totally willing to learn from us. We've been totally willing to learn from them. And there's a much more higher regard or appreciation for the individual components of this work and what each one's mission is and how we actually truly do that in parallel, simultaneously, and we coordinate and communicate between it. And hey, the best thing that we've said out loud, I think, in our training is, hey, look, the cops are here to stop the killing and we're here to stop the dying. You know, that's a pretty gross, high-level statement, but it is true. And if we can build our system on those two elements fundamentally, we're going to be in a pretty good position.
Right on. Well, I think that's a good spot to call it a day.
Cool.
Hey, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, this is cool. I like this. Wow. I like this a lot.
Special thanks to Deputy Chief Chris Stewart for coming out and sitting and talking with us and sharing with us some of his thoughts and ideas. And it's my hope that we can take these concepts and recognize where our deficiencies are, recognize how we can be more connected to operations and more connected to our mission and best figure out how to serve the community. Let's get out there and get some.